part of the additional motivation for this issue on food is a discussion I had a couple of years ago with a lady named Dr. Anne-Marie Colbin in New York City. She's been teaching what she calls holistic nutrition for a long time. And as we were discussing it, she really brought to my attention this notion that there's something about the chef's intention that makes a big difference in the people who eat the food. And even in a very mundane case, for example, a really good restaurant will have, if you go into the back kitchen and you see what's going on, it may be a very efficient, but it's not an angry place. If it's too angry, like we see sometimes with celebrity chefs on TV,
sure,
I'm not sure I want to eat that food.
Well, that's true. Or keep in mind fast food places where generally some of the workers aren't happy that day.
And then you have a double whammy.
Yes.
You have food which is not so great for you in the first place, made by people who may not be so happy. So it raises questions that begin to challenge the biochemical model of food. So this led to, for years I was thinking about how do we do an experiment involving this. And last summer, a gentleman presented himself and to me, and it turns out that he owns the only chocolate plantation in the United States, which is in the big island of Hawaii. And the plantation is called Hawaiian Vintage Chocolate. Their website's HawaiianVintage.com.
All right.
And he said, well, this is a very interesting idea, because he also had the sense that there was something interesting about intention and food. And in his case, when he originally brought the cacao trees over to Hawaii, nobody knew if they were going to grow or not. But as it turns out, that his plantation is next to a Buddhist monastery, and the Dalai Lama came to visit one day and was intrigued by the cacao trees, and so he blessed it. So this plantation basically began with a blessing from the Dalai Lama. You can't go bad from there.
You can't beat that, no,
right.
Not at all.
So he's interested in this intentional idea, and we said, okay, well, if you give me the chocolate, why don't we use chocolate as the food in this experiment? Now, I did this for a couple of reasons. One is that whenever you do a clinical trial, it's usually difficult to get people to volunteer for it, because they have to do something that's different during their daily life, and it may involve something unpleasant or whatever. In this case, though, we had to recruit people by saying, I'll tell you what, if you'll eat chocolate for 3 days, at the end of that, if you fill out these questionnaires, I'll give you $20. So we were overrun.
You would think they'd give you the $20
yeah.
after those 3 days.
Well, now that we did the experiment, we could have made probably more than $20. But the idea was we wanted to get at least 60 people, and after 120 people started beating down our door, we realized that this was probably a good design. So the experiment worked like this. And by the way, I would like to go back later to experiments involving water and
okay.
also photons, but I'll just concentrate on chocolate for the moment. The experiment was, first of all, it's a clinical trial, which means that it's not something happening in the lab, but it's happening in daily life. It's a real-world experiment. It's called a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled design, which is the gold standard in medical research. And what this does is it means that since we're giving people a substance to eat, like you might give somebody a pill to take,
mm-hmm.
they don't know whether it's a placebo or an active substance.
The old-called sugar pill, right?
Exactly.
The
in
placebo.
This case, it's chocolate. But it's chocolate that's either treated by intention or not treated by intention. And the double-blind part of it is that not only do the people eating the chocolate not know what they're eating, but I didn't know and my research assistant didn't know either. So none of us could be biased by the handling of it or anything else.
Who did know?
Actually, the way we designed it was that the person who owned the chocolate plantation knew. He's actually a co-author on this paper.
Okay.
But he then prepared the chocolate elsewhere, gave it to us, so he was hands-off once he gave us the chocolate.
Okay.
We had nothing
okay.
to do with any of the participants. So we chose 60 people, and we divided them into groups of 15, four groups of 15. So this is a small-scale study, a pilot study. One group would get chocolate that was not treated, It's off-the-shelf chocolate that comes from Hawaiian vintage chocolate. You can buy it through their website. It's like a gourmet brand of chocolate of 68% cacao.
Okay, now when you say not treated, chocolate without that intention?
That's right.
Okay.
The same chocolate you'd buy right through the website. Then we had three different kinds of intentional processes that we exposed the other chocolate to. The first people exposing it or putting an intentional imprint were a pair of highly experienced meditators from the Deer Park Buddhist Center in Wisconsin. So this is a famous Tibetan Buddhist monastery, and two of the highly experienced meditators were asked to think a very specific intention to impress into the chocolate, which was in front of them.
Okay.
The intention was that a person eating this chocolate would experience an enhanced sense of energy, vigor, and well-being. We thought that was a safe enough thing to try to influence into the chocolate. And we explained it to the meditators, and they thought that was fine, so they went ahead and did it. The second method was to take a different batch of chocolate and get six meditators, also from the Deer Park Buddhist Center. And instead of having the chocolate actually in front of them, they had an electronic device which would capture their intention. This was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So they meditated around this electronic device with the same intention. The device was then placed for 5 days in the vicinity of a batch of chocolate and allowed to, quote, play back the intention for five
basically
days.
Basically beam itself at the chocolate.
Right.
Okay.
The third method was a ritual performed by a Mongolian shaman that visits the United States once a year. His name is Zorit Patar Banzar. He's a chief shaman in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. I've seen pictures of this place, and it's like being on the moon. It's in the middle of nowhere, so it's a very classic Mongolian shamanism. He actually did this ceremony in our lab here in California, and I was present, and my research assistant, Gail Hasen, was also present. And we basically watched him do drumming and chanting and that sort of thing for about an hour over the chocolate.